here.
Today, anybody that wasn't here last time, this room's kind of hot. You want to leave the door open? Okay. I noticed last time I was a little bit shinier than when I came in. All right, so I want to make sure, and I'll see if I can get to do something about the air as well in here. So what we're doing last time, and we're leading up into getting to Immanuel Kant. Last time I talked about the continental rationalists and exhausted their repertoire over here, where we have René Descartes, Baruch Spinoza, and Gottfried Leibniz. And remember, the thing that held them all together was that primarily, and generally speaking, they held that the key to our knowledge and what we can know exists in our mind, and what we can rationalize about the world with our own minds, with our own intellect. And so the key to what we can know is contained in our minds. And for Descartes, that works itself out in that primarily what we are and who we are as human beings is we're creatures of thought. He says, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. So I know what I am as a human being is a thinking thing. And this extends into Spinoza, where, you know, the universe, God, sive deus natura, is the universe, nature itself, is one system of which thought is merely an attribute. And in Leibniz, we have the world reducible to monads. Literally, the universe itself is constructed out of thought. It's built out of thought. And I told you that the way he gets that is if you take an extended substance, some sort of physical thing, and keep subdividing it, until you get to a point where you can't subdivide it anymore. Well, if it can't be subdivided, it's not extended. And if it's not extended, it has to be unextended. An unextended substance is thought. And so we find ourselves going up to Leibniz. I told you he had a student named Christian Wolff, who was the teacher of Immanuel Kant. So when Immanuel Kant starts his early career in Königsberg, Prussia, he's been exposed to this rationalist tradition and comes from this rationalist tradition because of his teacher. His teacher, Wolff, was himself a student of Leibniz. And then last time I also started talking about the empiricist tradition, beginning with John Locke, and in general, what the empiricists have in common is that the universe, or what we can know about the universe, our knowledge comes primarily not from our reason, although our reason is involved, but our knowledge primarily comes through our sense experience. And that's what it means, just generally speaking, to be an empiricist, is that knowledge comes primarily through our senses. And so Locke distinguished between primary and secondary qualities, simple and complex ideas. But basically, there's a relationship between objects out there and what my mind does, where there's things inherent in an object that are primary qualities, and then there are parts of that experience of experiencing an object that are subjective, all right? Berkeley, on the other hand, he has a sort of idealism, which is to say everything's thought, and he says to be is to be perceived. So in his case, he also denies that primary, secondary quality distinction and says really everything is subjective. Everything's secondary qualities. And things only exist insofar as they are perceived, but thank goodness there's a big perceiver upstairs, namely God, who is watching everything and perceiving everything and making things tick the way that they ought. And this leads us to David Hume. So we've done an Englishman, we've talked about an Irishman, now we get to the Scotsman. All right, David Hume. David Hume starts his empirical theory by looking things, of course, just as Leibniz was sort of the extreme example of the rationalists, Hume himself is the extreme example of the empiricists. So whereas Locke said, you know, there's primary and secondary qualities in things, and we have ideas based on impressions, all right, through sensation and reflection. And Berkeley said, well, there's really only subjective experience, but we still perceive. There still has to be a perceiver. Hume denies that. Hume says, really, all we are as people, we are bundles of perceptions. So Hume, first of all, denies the existence of the soul. Now, he means the existence of the soul in two ways. First, he means that there is no such thing as a spiritual, that is, non-physical thing residing in you that makes you who you are. So that's what he means in one sense when he says there's no soul. But in another sense, he also means that there is no such thing as the self. There is no you. There is no person behind all your experiences. All that you are and all that I am is a collection of sensational experiences. I touch this, I see this, I smell this. All we are is basically a bunch of collections of those experiences. That's all there is to you. You don't have, you're not really a person, you're not really an, in later thought, like Fichte, you're not really a Das Ich, you're not an I, you have no consciousness, you're really just only the perceptions that you have. And so we're bundles of perceptions, and so all we have are the experiences that we have. And this is similar in a lot of ways to the Buddhist concept of the Anatman. That the Anatman in Buddhism is the idea that there's really no self, there's no soul, everything's impermanent. He wasn't influenced necessarily straightforward from there, but there is a correspondence. Now, what Hume spends a lot of his time doing, all right, saying as we're just bundles of perception and focusing on the validity of empirical experience, is he wants to take a look at science. And the empiricists like science, I wouldn't say more than the rationalists, because Descartes does a lot of science. But they're very focused on science because they recognize that most scientific investigation has its basis in empiricism. We watch things out in the world, and that tells us what the world is like. And we make, you know, sort of generalizations about what we see in nature, and that's really what science is. And this leads me, first of all, to what we call from Hume the problem of induction. So for Hume, induction is a problem. We'll also get to causality as a problem. All right, and then finally we'll get to what is called Hume's fork. That's what I want to talk about with Hume. And then all this will lead us to Kant, and all this has very much to do with Kant, because Immanuel Kant, even though he was, you know, himself German, comes out of this tradition, reads David Hume in English, which is a very rare thing for any continental thinker to do, even to this day, all right, is to read David Hume in English. And when he reads David Hume, he has some problems. It shakes him up a bit, and we'll talk about that when we get there. So here are the problems that Hume perceives. First of all, there's the problem of induction. Now, induction is a kind of logic unlike deduction. Deduction is where, from axiomatic principles, you can know something with absolute certainty, all right, where you can have a valid inference. And something, a conclusion in an argument is valid if and only if, given that the premises are true, and it's impossible for the conclusion to be false. Induction doesn't work the same way. Induction is always invalid in a deductive sense, but induction says things like this. I see an example of something, I see another example of something, I see another example of something, and therefore, I can conclude, I guess, X, and I'll just put another abbreviation down here. X is always like this. So here's what I mean. Let's take the example of a duck. Let's say X equals a duck. And so I see a duck, and the duck I see is white. I see another duck, and that duck I see is white. I see another duck, and that duck I see is white. And so therefore, I conclude for, in predicate logic, upside down A means all, I can conclude that for all X, so for all ducks are white. And that is an inductive argument, or an inductive argument. There's a problem with this. All right, and this is the problem of induction according to Hume. Well, what happens when I see another duck and it's not white? Anything else, black, red, green, what does that mean for the truth of this? Is it true? No, it's not true. Well, as soon as the instant I see one exception to the rule doesn't work anymore. So not, what's that?
I was just about to say it's true until you see another colored duck.
Yeah, it's true. So yeah, if you only see three ducks and they're all white and you go around thinking, well, all ducks are white, well, so far your experience has been legitimized and validated. But as soon as you find an exception, it doesn't work. And so Hume says, this is what science has a tendency to do, even in its most complex forms. It says, you know, today you boiled water at 100 degrees Celsius, I think. right, that doesn't sound right, but we'll say water freezes. You have your thermometer and you go outside and you watch water freeze at 0 degrees Celsius. And you go out the next day and see water freeze at 0 degrees Celsius. And the next day you see water freezes at 0 degrees Celsius. So then you conclude somewhat similarly to this, water always freezes at 0 degrees Celsius. Now Hume wants to say, well, yeah, it's done that every time you've ever tried it. But tomorrow you might go outside and water could freeze at 30 degrees Celsius. And you will say, no, that's scientifically impossible. Well, why is that scientifically impossible? Well, because of this rule. Well, he just showed you. This kind of reasoning, those kind of rules are based on this. And these always have a potential to be proven to be false. So induction, which is the basis of scientific inquiry. So things like when we say, like, well, water freezes at 0 degrees Celsius, it comes from this kind of reasoning. We've always tried it this way, and we probably have more than one X. We probably have, you know, millions of instances where we've measured that temperature. But what Hume says is, well, even if you have a set of a million times where it works, if you get one time where it doesn't work or doesn't fit, that proves and that demonstrates that it's wrong. And that's the problem with induction. It could always be wrong. It seems like it's right. All right. It seems like it's right. The sun came up today. The sun came up yesterday. Is the sun going to come up tomorrow? Well, maybe not. Now, it seems based on your experience that you like to think so. Well, of course the sun's going to come up tomorrow. Well, yeah, you'd like to think that because what Hume says is our everyday experience, we get so comfortable with it that we tend to just expect things to happen. We expect that if I let go of this eraser, it's going to drop into the ground. Is it? Well, it's done that in my experience every time I've ever dropped something. It might just float there. It might go up. You think gravity is something that's constant and always there, but his point is we really can't say, since all that observation, all our general rules about science are based on this kind of inquiry, we can't say with any certainty this really works because it could always be wrong, with one exception. As soon as you find one exception, it can be false. And do we know right now, anyone in this room, every instance of anything? Do you know every single time that water is frozen? No, so you don't know. All right, and so there's this skepticism there. That says, well, you can't know. So we do this, and he says, he's not saying don't do this, he's just saying, oh yeah, we can do this, but you can say the sun's going to come up tomorrow, that's great, but don't say it with certainty. All right, which Descartes is really upset now, because we want things that are clear and distinct, and what Hume is saying is really nothing is clear and distinct. There's nothing that we can know with absolute certainty. And then he continues with another aspect where he's analyzing something that's wrong with the way of our basic understanding, and that is the notion of causality or cause and effect. So cause and effect is the relationship between cause, or we could say, you know, efficient cause is what Aristotle would say. There is a cause and there is an effect. And based on our observation, a cause always precedes an effect. So for example, if I'm playing pool on a pool table and I hit the cue stick against the cue ball, and the cue ball hits the 8 ball into the corner pocket. What was the cause of the 8 ball going into the pocket?
God.
Well no, not definitely not for Hume. All right. That
I
would be.
I remember you using that analogy with.
Yeah.
What's his name?
Al-Ghazali. Yeah. Al-Ghazali. So yeah, Al-Ghazali said that. Al-Ghazali completely denied efficient causation, and he said, "Well, it's that God is the active cause of every event. All right. So anything that we see in nature, God's actually doing every individual step." Here, what Hume is saying is, with cause and effect, is that it seems like when I hit that ball and the ball hits the ball hitting the other ball causes the other ball to move. Hume denies this. He says, no, it didn't. And so what we think is, we tend to perceive, just like with induction, that, well, of course these things must be true. We perceive or we make up a necessity to this relationship that in fact does not exist. So we tend to think, you know, oh, I kicked this, and it moved. Hume says, my foot did not cause that. Now, we can talk about the world in order to be accurate and not be, you know, fumbling over ourselves. We can talk about things like that, and that's okay. But don't say with absolute certainty that caused that. All that happened was this. There was event A, and there was event B. All you can say is give a chronology of what happened. Well, I kicked a little door there, and then the door moved. So all I can have are conjunctions. I can have no causal relationship between anything. Everything just happens. Things that we call causes are actually just antecedents in time. There's no relate. Take away my foot in the door. What do you have? Nothing. Right? That's what Hume says. There's no necessary connection between event A and event B. All we have is one event and then succeeded by another event. There's no necessary connection between the two. Now, of course, he wants to say, like, you know, if I rolled this chair, I caused it to roll. He says, well, great. We can talk about that surely in everyday speech. But in reality, there is no necessary relationship between cause and effect. So what this means is when people have said historically, well, there has to be a first cause, so God exists. Well, he says, well, there doesn't have to be a cause because there's really no such thing as a cause. Right? So that goes out the window. But also, you know, Hume's dissatisfied himself because science is based on, you know, understanding causality. What causes this? All right? That's the nature of science. Science ultimately is the study of efficient causation. What causes this? Heat does this. What caused us to evolve in this way? What caused this to happen this way? What caused the universe to be the way it is? Those are scientific questions. And science is predicated upon these two kinds of investigation, which Hume ends up concluding. Now, he's not rejoicing about this, but he ends up concluding that both of these are bogus. Both of these are bogus. And then finally, that leads us to another thing that Hume brings up called Hume's fork. All right, and with Hume's fork, Hume says that basically there are two kinds of propositions that exist. Propositions are statements, okay? There are two kinds of propositions. First of all, we have what he calls analytic, a.k.a. a priori, a.k.a. necessary propositions, versus synthetic, a posteriori, contingent propositions. And then also there's a third category, which is just nonsense. So he believes that there's three categories of propositions. Now, these guys are British, all right? So I will say this generally, even though these are not continental and analytic thinkers in the contemporary sense, the continental tradition that's going to follow finds a lot of their basis in these guys. And the analytic tradition is going to find a lot of their basis in these guys. So you'll find people in the 20th century analytic philosophers like the Vienna School and the logical positivists are going to say things like Hume. All right, there's one thing that they'll add later on. But so here's what this means. What is an analytic a priori necessary proposition? Well, that's something like, it's something that's tautological, all right? In other words, it's something that's true in and of itself, or we could say true by definition. So like saying a triangle has three sides, that is analytic. Because when I say a triangle, or I'll just say, make it use the verb to be, a triangle is a three-sided figure. I think we'd all agree with that. Well, here's the subject, here's the predicate. Everything in the predicate is contained within the concept of the subject of the sentence. All right. So this is analytic. That's what analytic means. The predicate is contained in the subject. So I could also, since the predicate is contained in the subject, I could say, it would be just as meaningful to say, a triangle is a triangle, or a three-sided figure is a three-sided figure. The predicate adds no new information for me. It's all embedded, it's already there. And so that's an analytic statement, an analytic proposition. It's necessarily true. You don't have to think about, well, three-sided, it could be a four-sided figure. No, that's not a triangle, all right, at that point. It's also a priori, which means we know it prior to experience, which means, and he's somewhat optimistic here about these, unlike with induction and causality, something that's a priori or necessary, we can know it prior to experience. So if it's necessary in this sense, something like a triangle is a three-sided figure, we don't have to go out and look for every triangle in the world to see if it actually has three sides. That's just part of the concept of triangle, so we don't have to worry about that, so that's a good thing. But then also we have down here what are called synthetic propositions. And a synthetic proposition is any proposition where the predicate is not contained in the subject. OK? Okay? So, for example, if I say there is, well, let's do this. My car is green. Okay, there's the verb to be, so there's the predication. Here's the subject. Here's the predicate. Now, is green in the concept of car the same way three-sided figure is in the concept of triangle? No. I could also have a red car, I could have a blue car, I could have a white car, so on and so forth. So this information is new information. It's not something that's contained in the subject. The predicate is adding something new that's not in the definition of car. So this is called synthetic, which means it's something also a posteriori. You could only demonstrate it to be true by looking at the experience. So a triangle is a three-sided figure. I can know that right off the bat. My car is green. What would I have to do to figure out, or for you to figure out that this is actually true?
Experience.
Yeah, experience. Go out and take a look at it. Eyes confirm it's green. Bam. It's true. All right? So both these kinds of statements can be either true or false. Then we have a third category that he just calls nonsense. All right? And nonsense would be anything that's neither analytic or synthetic. That is, it can't be true by definition, but it also, it can't be confirmed by experience either. All right? So something as rudimentary, he spends a lot of time on this in his Dialogues of Religion. God is good. Well, here's the subject. Here's the predicate. There's the predication in the verb to be. Well, God's the subject. God is good. Now, is that an analytic statement? Is goodness contained within the concept of God?
That depends on who you ask.
That's true. All right? That's very true. All right? So pretty much as you might recall, Mr. Clarkson, that if you think of the entirety of pretty much anybody we studied in medieval thought, how are they going to answer that question?
Yes.
Yep, absolutely. With Anselm especially. Well, of course, you can't think of God without him being good. Now, what do you think Hume's going to think on this? Nope. All right? Goodness is not contained in the concept of God for Hume. He would deny that it's an analytic statement. All right? So others would dispute that fact from the get-go. There are others who would say, well, yes, it is. God is good. God is great. Let us thank him for our food, all right? That's what people would do, all right? They'd say, well, of course God is good. He has to be. That's part of the nature of being God, all right? So people, there are some people that would dispute that and say it's analytic. He would say, no, it's not. It's not as clear, it's not as perspicuous as saying a triangle has three sides. So when you picture a triangle, you can say, oh, it has three sides. When you picture God, that goodness doesn't seem to come as immediately, all right, says Hume. Now, does someone have a question? I saw some writhing going on while I was talking. Okay.
Could you say that even if you don't believe in God, that would still be an analytical statement? Like you could be an atheist and agree that that would be an analytical statement just because of the definition?
You could say, you could say, the atheist hypothetically could say, well, in the concept of God, one might say there's embedded to the concept goodness. Mm-hmm. But then I just picture Anselm coming in and going, yeah, and it exists or else you're an idiot. Okay. That's what Anselm has an ontological argument where it says, you know, if you know anything about God and you understand the concept and you deny its existence, then you actually don't understand the concept. Mm-hmm. So if you don't believe God exists, well, you're an idiot. It's been proven. Plain logic. All right, that's what Anselm does. Now, so someone might still say, like an atheist or a non-theist of a varying variety, well, I don't believe in God, but I can admit that if there is a God, he's good. The point is here, Hume's just going to go, no. That's not analytic. Okay? So he's going to go ahead and say prima facie. That's not analytic. For Hume, all right. Again, that can be disputed, but something that he feels much more comfortable in not disputing is the fact is the synthetic. That's to say, if God is good, can we go out and look and see if he's good? You know, can we go out like we can go see my car and see if it's green? And go, yep, it's green. Is there any way we can see, hear, smell, taste, touch with immediacy and figure God is good? Okay, he's going to say no. And so, if it's not analytic and it's not synthetic, what's left? Nonsense. So this is nonsense, okay? It's gobbledygook. You might as well be going blah, 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 blah. All right? It's just as meaningful. It's nonsense, okay? Now, that's why at the very end of his enquiry concerning human understanding, he ends it by saying this. It's sort of a famous paragraph at the very end. He says, you know, does it? He says about if you're thinking about something, does it contain any number? All right, does it contain something that you can figure out analytically? No, move on. Does it contain something that's measurable or quantifiable? No, then move on. He says, consign it then to the flames, for it can contain nothing but sophistry and illusion. And that's referring to nonsense. So if it's something that's not analytic and it's something that's not synthetic, stop talking about it because it's nonsense. Yes, ma'am.
Are you saying that anything is subjective, like an opinion, any kind of opinion?
Yeah, if it's an opinion that cannot be substantiated either analytically or synthetically, at best, it doesn't have scientific certainty. And at worst, it's just complete idiocy. All right. So there are things you can say, well, like, I like ice cream. Is that analytic? Is that intrinsic to the concept of ice cream? Some people don't like it. Okay. But is it synthetic? I like ice cream. Well, actually, you could confirm you like it because you consume it a lot. All right. I could see if that's true or false. So that actually might be a synthetic statement. So even though it's an opinion, I can confirm the veracity of your opinion to be true. So in that sense, it's synthetic. You get that? But something like saying, well, I believe in the existence of God. Well, I can say, yeah, you do, all right, based on the evidence, but does God actually exist? The thing behind it is nonsense. Okay, does that make that more clear? Okay. So that's what's going on here. And so this is really how he ends. Now, Hume actually didn't publish any of this stuff in his lifetime. That's where these philosophers are interesting. He died in 1776, which is very easy to remember, right, for some reason. I don't know why. But he actually, in his own day, was a historian. So he wrote like a history of Europe. He wrote like a history of the world. And so in his own day, he was known as a historian. His philosophical views weren't really known until after he was dead. He was like, when I die, get this stuff out there, which philosophers often do. All right, Copernicus did the same thing. I think that the Earth goes around the sun, but don't tell anybody until after I'm dead. All right, you'll find people do that a lot in an age where they fear that they're going to be ostracized or persecuted for what they believe. Now, in Hume's case, so he says all this, and it comes out after he dies, late 1770s, while, you know, the colonials here at home are doing what they do. And then across the world, over in what is today Kaliningrad, Russia, which is this little, like, nugget of Russia that's separated from the rest of it. I guess analogous to Alaska in the mainland United States, except Alaska's huge. There's this little tiny bit of Russia that's just kind of free-floating, all right, on the Baltic. Well, back then, at the time, it was actually part of Germany, a German state called Prussia. And the city, instead of Kaliningrad, back then it was called Königsberg. And that's where Christian Wolff, the student of Leibniz, taught at Königsberg. And Immanuel Kant was there as a student, and so bought into the whole Leibnizian monadological view of the universe. But then sometime in like the early 1780s, Immanuel Kant read David Hume in English, which I said again is very fascinating because that's a rare thing to do. And when he reads it, it completely shakes the foundation of what he knows, because he's, you know, monads, great. And then, you know, we can know things with our mind, because everything's made out of mind, everything's made out of thought. He says, well, Hume said we can't do induction, we can't get causality, and there's a lot of nonsense out there, all right? But Kant says, well, some things that are nonsense are still good things, all right? Things like, well, he says we can't believe in the soul or the self. Well, can I confirm the self empirically? Can I see, hear, smell, taste, or touch myself? Not my body, myself, who I am, all right? My soul smells good. No, I can't come to those kinds of conclusions. Is soul or self intrinsic analytically to who I am? I am a soul. Is that predicate contained in the subject? So Kant starts to get very worried about these things. Are things like God is good or God exists? I want to believe that, but based on what Hume has said, it's frustrating for me to believe those things now. So this shatters his whole universe and what he believes. All right, being a Leibnizian and somewhat of a Lutheran as well. His mother was a Lutheran pietist. So he, you know, he reads this Humean stuff, and he says later on that Hume woke me from my dogmatic slumber, which is about one of the only two times Kant said anything that sounded somewhat poetic, all right? He said, there are two things for me that confirm the existence of God, the starry heavens above and the moral law within. That sounds catchy. Now, then again, you're not going to see anything that's... No one's going to want a lower back tattoo of anything Kant says in here. Okay. All right? How are synthetic a priori judgments possible? All right? No one's going to want to say that. So he says this, though. He says, Hume woke me from my dogmatic slumber. So he's in the Leibnizian rationalist camp, reads Hume and goes, I need to rethink some things. But then he starts to wonder, you know, the problem, he says, is, well, how can I... You know, he looks at this analytic synthetic stuff and goes, okay, I like that. All right, but for Hume, all a priori things are analytic, which means something that's a priori, like a triangle has three sides, that's a priori and it's analytic. All right, the predicate's contained in the subject, which means analytic, and it's a priori. I know it without having to go out and prove it. Okay. Hume also said that all synthetic judgments are a posteriori, which means that it's synthetic. The predicate is not contained in the subject, but I can know it after experience. All right, I can only confirm this after experience. Then what Kant wants to say is, aha, I have a way out of this. Kant says, I believe there is such a thing as synthetic statements or propositions that are a priori. Wait a minute. Here's what he means. So he says, there are propositions that exist in the mind that we can know prior to experience, but they're things where the predicate is not contained in the subject. Now, Hume denied this. Hume said all analytic judgments are a priori, all synthetic judgments are a posteriori. Kant says, I think there's some synthetic a priori judgments. Well, like what? Well, now that's what we're going to get into looking at Kant. And so most of what I've said heretofore has been sort of a general overview. Now we're going to delve into the text, which I'm sure you all thoroughly enjoy. All right. Now, the thing is, Kant is, as you've noticed, extremely dense. All right. So we're going to work our way through this, and feel free to just, especially in this upper level class, I almost wish we had like a circular room, like the conference room down the hall for this class. All right. Those of you who are in my logic class know I don't want to be in there for that class because it's so large. This is small enough, that would be better. But feel free to stop at any moment and say, I don't get this, okay? Or ask a question of any kind, all right, that's confirming your intuitions. So let's open up now to the beginning here. And the first thing he does, and I want to show you what he's trying to do. He's been influenced both by the rationalists, and so I'm going to start on page 7. He's been influenced both by the rationalists and the empiricists, and what he wants to do at this point is where they've disagreed, he wants to make it fit together. It's what Plato did with Heraclitus and Parmenides, okay? It's what Aristotle did with Plato and empiricism in his own day. It's also what Thomas did with Aristotle and the Christian tradition. Great philosophers are synthetic thinkers, synthetic in the sense that they can synthesize together, not synthetic as in not containing the predicate. So I'm equivocating there. So he says this in the first line, all right? This is something, the first line David Hume would love. He says, there can be no doubt that all our knowledge begins with experience. Great, all right? That's something, it sounds like empiricism, but then he follows it with this. For how should our faculty of knowledge be awakened into action did not objects affecting our senses partly of themselves produce representation? So he says, you know, obviously our knowledge begins with experience. Second paragraph. But though all our knowledge begins with experience, and now Hume would raise an eyebrow, it does not follow that it arises out of experience. So that is to say this. The first part there, the first thing he said, agrees with the empiricists. All right? All of our knowledge comes from experience. But it doesn't arise from, all right? It doesn't arise from experience. So our knowledge comes from experience, but that's not the thing that makes our knowledge work. Well, then what is that? Well, that's what he wants to find out. So moving on to the next paragraph, he says this. He says, well, we need to figure this out a little bit more, all right? So he says, this then is a question which at least calls for closer examination and does not allow of any offhand answer, whether there's any knowledge that is thus independent of experience or even of all impressions of the senses. Such knowledge is called a priori. That's something, you know, before experience. as we've said, as distinguished from the empirical, which has its sources in a posteriori, that is, in experience. And then he says, a priori is not a helpful term. Okay? Because what we do, and he says what we do in science, is we have a priori principles, but then really when we're looking at things in nature, we do things like induction. We generalize from what we see in nature. Okay? But what we want to do is ultimately figure out what causes us to be able to understand the world in which we live and understand how we know what we know. And so what we need to do is figure out the foundations of our own knowledge and our own experience. And so this brings us to now really the second part there where it says we are in possession of certain modes of a priori knowledge, okay, which is a very long header there. But it says this, we are now in possession of certain modes of a priori knowledge, and even the common understanding is never without them. So what we need to do is we need to distinguish between what he calls pure knowledge and empirical knowledge. And they're generally speaking, I mean, this book is called Kritik den reinen Vernunft in auf Deutsch or in German, right, which is Critique of Pure Reason is the book that this comes from. And it's basically, that book is like 300 pages, and this selection whittles down a lot. Okay, so it's about 15 pages. So he says, well, there's empirical knowledge that we have, knowledge of things, but there's pure knowledge we have. And pure knowledge is knowledge that is untainted by our experience. It's unempirical, all right? So it's something that comes from the mind. So notice what he's doing here is he's combining their methods, all right, trying to reconcile them together. That is the empiricist and the rationalist. We have the empiricist who said there's only empirical knowledge, and the rationalist who said there's only pure, only rational knowledge. Kant's admitting there's both, all right. And he says all our knowledge, of course, like he said at the very beginning, begins with experience, but it doesn't seem to be the case that knowledge can arise from experience. And he says we do have a priori judgments, all right? So those are pure things, things like knowledge of mathematics, things like triangles have three squares, okay? And he also mentions here that we see things like there are things such as mathematical judgments, judgments of causality. These are all things that we recognize a priori. Even though Hume had denied things like causality, we nevertheless perceive these things in the world a priori. All right, so we perceive causality, we perceive generalizations, but there has to be something that makes all this work. And now we're moving on to part three. So far, this is all prolegomena. All right, that is to say, it's all introductory here. He's saying, well, man, we think, or we know that, but and we think as a combination of these two methods, empiricism and rationalism, sort of together. But what we need to do, starting in the third section there on the left column of page 9, is we need to figure out certain modes of knowledge leave the field of all possible experience and have the appearance of extending the scope of our judgments beyond all limits of experience, and this by means of concepts to which no corresponding object can ever be given in experience. So that's to say this. We need to figure out what we can know and what we can't know. We need to figure out, there needs to be a science that tells us specifically what we can know and what we can't know. And this is somewhat similar to what Hume was doing here in his four. Here's what we can know. This stuff is stuff we talk about. We really can't know it. In fact, it's nonsense completely. Kant's saying, well, let's come up with a very specific way other than going, is it analytic, is it synthetic, or is it something else? Let's be exhaustive in attempting to understand what we can know and what we can't know. All right, and what he ends up saying here is that there are some things that we can know, all right, beyond experience, all right, perhaps. He says this. This is the second paragraph under section 3, left column, page 9. It is precisely by means of the latter modes of knowledge, in the realm beyond the world of experience, where experience can yield neither guidance nor correction. So there's some things we say that we know that we can't see, hear, smell, taste, touch. Well, like what? And he says, here's a problem with trying to talk about those things. Indeed, we prefer to run every risk of error rather than desist from such urgent inquiries. In other words, we like talking about these things so much we can't shut up about it. But it's dangerous because we really can't do these things with accuracy. On the ground of their dubious character or from disdain and indifference, these unavoidable problems set by pure reason itself are God, freedom, and immortality. So what he says here is this. There are three things we have a tendency to talk about that we really don't have any business talking about. Exhaustively, all right, or in an informed way. God, freedom, and immortality. All things that Hume would say, nonsense. Okay? Well, Kant says, okay, Hume would call it nonsense, great.
How would Hume call freedom nonsense before you go any further?
Are you free? So let's tease this out. So are you free?
To do what?
Well, give me an example of something you think you're free to do. Now, there are biological, spatial limitations to what you just did, and what you did was an act of will that's been biologically preconditioned into you based on genetics and so forth. And so you actually think you did that freely just now, but you were always determined to do it. Now, I can do that in a theistic way where you know, like Al-Ghazali, God determined you to do that from the beginning of time. It's providential. But I can do it in a non-theistic way as well. You had certain biological predispositions to start throwing things around in my classroom, all right? All right, but you were disposed to do it. You were determined to do it. So were you free? And so even a non-theistic philosopher can say things like, oh, you think you have free will. Did you pick your parents before you were born? No, then you're not free. Can you fly right now? Not in a plane, just as an act of will. Can you start floating or levitating? No, then you're not free. And you don't have free will. You lose. All right, says Hume. All right, says Hume. All right. Says Hume, or so I'm talking.
I mean, within the confines of biology and physics, I'm free.
Are you?
I would think so. I mean, I can't break the laws of physics.
Mitosis, right now, do it. I'm split into two.
I would say that's a limit of physics and biology.
Oh, so it's a limit. Well, so if there's a limit, there's not freedom. Okay. If there's a limit, there's not freedom in that sense. Just like, you know, in economics, can you have a limited free market? No, all right? Well, that's what they're trying to do in China, all right? You have a limited free market. Is it a free market? No, all right, because it's limited, all right? And so you can't have something be limited and be free, even in this metaphysical sense, all right? So these things, we talk about them, but he also means freedom of will, especially, like free will is what he has. But can you really know you're free? Even if you're a slave, all right? You might be a slave to something, and think you're free to do something, but you're not. You might be enslaved to something. Like, for example, someone who denies a problem that they have, someone who's an alcoholic, for example, is a slave to alcohol. Oh, I'm free, I can stop whatever I want. Freedom is an illusion that you don't have, okay? Nietzsche's gonna come along later on and say, well, freedom also, it's an illusion made up by people in power too, all right? To make you feel good about yourself. It doesn't actually exist at all right? But you can't really understand God, all right? We can't talk about him because we can't see, hear, smell, taste, touch it. God smells good. You can't say that, according to Hume, all right? And Kant's agreeing, okay? We can't really talk about these things with accuracy. And the reason why there's so many good arguments for the existence of God and so many good arguments for the non-existence of God, which he calls antinomies. That's sort of a technical term for contradictions, and he'll talk about this more later on. But the reason why there's such a conflict is because we're talking about stuff that we can't talk about. So I could stand here before you and give you a good argument for the reason that God exists, and you go, yeah, I agree with that. And then give you a really good argument for why God does not exist, and you might go, yeah, I agree with that too. That's a problem, all right? Which is it? And Kant says the reason why is because these things are categories we can't really talk about. And he'll talk about why, and he'll explain it why over the course of this work. We can't really talk about these with any accuracy. Right here, it's safe to say, because they're empirically unverifiable. Okay, we can't. These are something beyond the realm of experience. All right, beyond the realm of the senses. And he says that what the philosophy, the branch of philosophy called metaphysics does, is a branch of philosophy called metaphysics. Now, literally, it means before the physics, and that's kind of a pun now, because people say, oh, it means before the physics, as in, here's the physical world, what's beyond the physics? This is actually not what it means. Actually, Aristotle had a book called Physics, and in the anthologies of Aristotle, there was a book that was literally before the physics that they called metaphysics for that reason. So that's why metaphysics is called metaphysics. All right. So it's ended up taking up a double meaning of sorts. And metaphysics in this sense is not when you go to the metaphysics section in the bookstore, all right, when you see a lot of crystal balls and things of that nature, all right? This is a different brand of metaphysics altogether. But he says metaphysics is basically the philosophy which tries to do all this, all right? It tries to answer these questions about God. That's what Plato was doing. Plato was talking about, there's the forms up in the world of forms beyond, and all our knowledge corresponds to these archetypes, these ideal archetypes that are immaterial. Kant would say, well, you're doing metaphysics and trying to talk about things that are not confirmable or verifiable by experience, and that's a problem. And he says the problem with metaphysicians is while they start talking about these things like, oh yes, God exists, or yes, we have free will, or yes, the soul is immortal, or there is a soul. Kant wants to say, while they talk about these things a lot, that is, metaphysicians, philosophers doing metaphysics, one thing that they apparently don't do is ever talk about our capacity or lack of capacity for reasoning about such. They never talk about, well, what is the equipment that we have that helps us figure these things out? He's not saying there is or is not here, but he does say, well, they never examine what kind of equipment that we have. So in the following paragraph, he says this. So here's the danger in trying to talk about these things like God, freedom, and immortality. Now, it does indeed seem natural that as soon as we have left the ground of experience, we should, through careful inquiries, assure ourselves as to the foundations of any building that we propose to erect, not making use of any knowledge that we possess without first determining whence it has come, and not trusting to principles without knowing their origin. So, for example, if you were trying to understand the nature of a building, all right, architecturally speaking, you'd want to say, well, what is the foundation of something? So what Kant wants to do here is understand what are the foundations of our knowledge. And he says, continuing, it is natural, that is to say, that the question should first be considered how the understanding can arrive at all this knowledge a priori, and what extent, validity, and worth it may have. So he's already agreeing with Hume that we have a priori knowledge of things. All right, he agrees with this so far. But what he's asking now is, how can we know that we have a priori knowledge of things? What is the means by which we can say a triangle has three sides and know that without having to confirm, you know, let me check this triangle. How is it that we have an ability to do that? All right. How is it that we have the ability to have a priori knowledge of things? And then we continue to section four, where what he does here is he recapitulates a lot of what Hume does in his Fork. He says that there is a distinction between analytic and synthetic judgments. And what we have here to begin with in the first two paragraphs are something completely similar to what Hume said, with one exception. He is not connecting with necessity analytic with a priori and synthetic with a posteriori. Right? For Hume, these two are, for Hume, if something's synthetic, it's a posteriori, and vice versa. All right. So if something's synthetic, if and only if it's a posteriori. And for Hume, if something's analytic, it's analytic if and only if it's a priori. Right. So those go back and forth. You can put, if something's analytic, it's a priori. If something's a priori, it's analytic. That's what Hume said. Kant's not going to do that. He's going to say, well, listen, we've got what I said earlier. In all judgments which the relation of a subject to the predicate is thought, skip everything there in the parentheses, this relation is possible in two different ways. Either the predicate B belongs to the subject, A, as something which is contained in this concept, A. All right, so like a triangle has three sides, the three-sidedness is contained in the concept. Or B lies outside the concept of A. So something like, my car is green. Green being B, it lies outside of the concept of the car. We're on page 9, right column, first paragraph. Analytic judgments are therefore those in which the connection of the predicate with the subject is thought through identity. Those in which this connection is thought without identity, that is, it's not in the definition itself, like my car is green, should be entitled synthetic. The former as adding nothing through the predicate to the concept of the subject, but merely breaking it up into those constituent concepts that have all along been through in it. So like, triangle has three sides. Well, the three-sidedness is a constituent part of being a triangle. All right, it's the nature of being a triangle. And so he says, analytic judgments, things that are contained in themselves. Like all, he says, all bodies are extended. Now that's sort of an appeal to Locke. So if something is physical, it's extended. That's like saying if something's physical, it's physical. Is that analytic? Yes, all right, because it's the predicate's contained in the subject. Then moving on, he says in the next paragraph, the very bottom right column, page 9, judgments of experience as such are one and all synthetic. So anything that's experiential, anything that comes through the senses, is something that's synthetic. For it would be absurd to found an analytic judgment on experience. Okay. Great. So he says we have the analytic, like we do with Hume. We have the synthetic, like we do with Hume. But then in the next paragraph, he's going to do something quite peculiar. He says, but this. Third paragraph, now we're on page 10, about halfway down left column. But in an a priori synthetic judgment, this help is entirely lacking. Upon what then am I to rely when I seek to go beyond the concept A and to know that another concept B is connected with it? Through what is the synthesis made possible? So what he's asking here is he's saying, first of all, he's saying there's such a thing as synthetic a priori judgments. Now, this is something that prima facie Hume would say there's no such thing, because anything, if it's synthetic, it's a posteriori. It looks like Kant here is crossing over his categories, okay? Kant is saying, oh, there are synthetic a priori judgments. Hume would go, but synthetic things are from experience, they're a posteriori, they're not a priori. How could you possibly have a synthetic a priori? What would that be? Well, synthetic is something where the predicate is not contained in the subject, but a priori means you know it before experience. How is that even possible? Well, let me give all of you an illustration that Kant does not do here, but I think it's helpful. All of you, and I might have done this with something before. Everybody here, in your mind, picture a cube. Picture a cube, you can spin it around in your head, okay? How many edges, not sides, how many edges does the cube have? Twelve, that's right. What you just did was a synthetic a priori judgment. And knowing that it's 12. Now here's how it's synthetic a priori. If you go look, first of all, if you go look in a dictionary and you look at the definition of cube, it's not going to say a 12-edged figure. Okay? So that's not the definition. It's not part of the concept of a cube even. Alright, so it's not part of, the predicate's not contained in the subject. You don't say a cube is a 12-edged figure. Alright, it's not part of the subject. And even though, like, I saw you all counting it up in your head, all right? Like, oh, there's the bottom, and there's the middle, and there's the top. I'm just trying to confirming your own geometric map. But here's the thing. You had to count it up in your mind. But in your mind, when you pictured it in your head, there's no way you could have thought of it without having 12 edges automatically in your mind. So your mind pictured that automatically without you even being aware of it. There's no way you can picture a cube without having 12 edges. So your mind did that for you. And then you had to sort of follow it up, all right? But your mind automatically was able to generate that shape in what these philosophers would call your imagination. And you were able to do that synthetic a priori. Yes?
But wouldn't you have to experience a cube before you're able to do that?
Not if you, like, so if we knew that a cube had six sides, whatever six sides would be, would we have to experience it to draw it in three dimensions? Or so if I told you, for example, this, when it regards to geometry, let's, for the sake of argument, say, this is hypothetically difficult, but let's say you've never seen a square before. So you've never seen a square, and I tell you it has four equal sides and four equal angles. If you've never seen one before, could you draw it? Yeah, you could. So you wouldn't have to experience it first, you'd know it a priori, all right, without prior experience. And so a cube sounds a little bit more complicated, But if you explain, and Socrates does this especially in Meno, all right, where he's like, tell this kid to draw a square in the dirt. All right, I don't know if any of you have ever read Meno. Basically, what Socrates does in Meno is proves that everybody knows math, whether they know it or not. He's demonstrating this point. So he tells someone to draw a cube, like draw a square in the ground. So a little slave boy draws a square in the ground. So it looks like this, where he's like, here, draws a square. So he draws a square, and that's not a perfect square, by the way. All right, you will never get such a thing from me on the board. Then Socrates, in the Meno, tells the boy to do this. Draw bisecting lines, all right? Or he says it a little bit more simply, like draw a line from one side to the other, one side to the other, assuming that it's a perfect square. It looks like this. He says, now, are those lines of equal length? The kid says, yeah, they are. Just look at it. And then Socrates turns to Meno and says, this kid has never done geometry before and was able to figure this out. Now, he doesn't say a priori because that's not a term in Plato, but that's what he's getting at. He's never done this before. First time doing this, you can see it right then. All right, and he knows it beforehand. All right. Now, for Plato, it's because we all have this knowledge floating around in our heads from before we were alive and our souls were floating in the world of forms, and you know, we were floating around looking at perfect squares and so forth in the great beyond. And then we've come down and we're trapped in our bodies and we're remembering things. But for Kant, Kant is going to say, basic mathematical concepts, we don't have to experience, we know them before we experience them. So something like a triangle, you can say it's a three-sided figure, you can figure it out. Just like I can tell you right now, you can say, you know what, I could say draw a 526-sided figure, and you all would hate me for it, but if I told you to draw it, you could do it, even though you've never experienced it before. So you get the concept without having had to experience it. And that's why things like mathematics are a priori. I can tell you, like, if I tell you 1, 2, 3, you know, so forth. Let's say, hypothetically, you know, I'm going to give you this math problem. What is 1,364 times 7,524,608? Now, the odds of you ever having this exact... I'm not asking you to actually do it, by the way. No one without a calculator. The odds of you knowing this exact problem or having done this exact problem before are very rare, okay? But could you do it? Yes, based on the a priori principles you already have in place, all right? So, you know, that it's not like, now I got that one down, I can always do it, all right? Once you get the basic mathematical concept of number, I could give you any addition problem and you could do it, unless I start throwing around like non-existent unreal numbers like aleph null, all right? Which is the which is infinity minus one. Don't think about that too hard. It will come up in analytic later on, all right?
There's a real number that's infinity minus one?
Yeah, aleph null, all right? So Hebrew letter aleph with a little zero next to it, subscript. It's infinity minus one. Which the whole point of that is when we get to analytic stuff is how you can think about concepts like that analytically. So can you think of infinity minus one?
No.
Well, we're talking about it, so apparently we can to some extent. But we have a hard time grasping the concept. I'm getting ahead of myself now. So in any case, to answer your question explicitly, Kant is going to say geometric figures, basic mathematics. He said Euclidean geometry. That's really what he wants to do, and he says it explicitly elsewhere. Euclidean geometry is a priori. And so the things that Euclid was doing with his axioms and propositions in ancient Greece were compiling mathematics together from Pythagoras and others. Like you don't need to have it explained to you. If you stared at a triangle long enough, you could figure out things like a squared plus b squared equals c squared. Now, the fact that Pythagoras already did that for you is helpful. All right? Or not. But if you looked at a triangle long enough, you could figure that out on your own. It's a priori. You wouldn't even have to experience a real triangular figure. Because even when we're drawing triangles, that's really a diagram of a triangle, okay? It's a representation of a three-sided figure. It's three marks on a board. It's not actually something triangular out in the world. So even this is diagrammatic, right? It's not a real triangle. Right? Or again, for Plato, the real triangle floating, I don't want to get into that. All right. So that's what he's saying here, all right? He's saying there is such a thing.
But no, just real quick, when you're getting back...
Let me reiterate. Questions are fine at all times. Go ahead.
I was going to say this when you first brought up the example of the cube. Someone had to teach me what, you know, what a square angle was. Someone had to teach me what, like, an actual line was. So, I mean, is it that...
So there are two kinds of a priori, all right? There's a priori in the sense of... Once you know something, then you always know it, all right? So, for example, if you know you You knowing that you'll only get a parking place on this campus if you show up before 9 o'clock. All right, if you've experienced it once a posteriori, and then you know it as a rule a priori. All right, so then you know it before your next experience. All right, so that's something I know a priori now. If I don't get here before 9, because all the students are going to park in all the faculty spots. All right.
I don't do
that. I let my rage go there for a second. All right.
Repeat the lines.
You'll see me out there with a roller. They're all yellow. All right. So, but then there are some things that what Kant would say are absolutely a priori. All right. Something like
pure a priori.
Yeah, they're pure a priori, pure, untainted by empirical experience. Something like the number one. Now, here's why it's a priori. Picture a one. Picture one. Picture oneness. Not the numeral one. Because these that I'm writing here on the board,
those are not numbers. Those are numerals. Because I could also just as easily write these. Those are Roman numerals. I'm sorry, those are Arabic numerals. These are Roman numerals. Those are all numerals. So if I say, what's a three? And you go this, and I go, well, what about this? Is that a 3-2? Yes, it is. Because they're both symbols representing the same concept, namely threeness. But so, what is oneness? Now the point here, Kant's going to go, see, you have a hard time with this, all right? Have you ever experienced a one? Not a $1 bill, not one as an adjective attached to a thing. Like, this is one table, here's two tables, here's many tables. Have you ever experienced one itself? Is the concept of one. Now we apply it to things, but Kant wants to say this concept you know a priori. Now not counting, then we're counting one and then two and then three and so forth. Not counting, but there's something we just know one. We get numbers. Even if like someone can count that doesn't know these symbols. Okay? We just get the concept. Alright?
Would some large extravagant number like 7 million or whatever you have up there be a priori too? Could you like
Everything until you get to abstract numbers like aleph null, infinity minus one.
Yeah.
All right. Then it causes a headache. All right. Or you know, negative zeta. All right. Or something like that, where you're dealing with abstract concepts. Then it ends up being problematic with what we call non-real numbers. I don't think they're unreal. But with real numbers, with not even integers, but real numbers. All right. And so zero is not one of those. Like one.
Yeah,
I anticipated that. So yeah, picture zero in your head. Well, you know, I think of Parmenides going, you can't think of nothing, because as soon as you think of nothing, you're thinking of something. Okay? So if you're thinking of nothing, you're actually thinking of something, therefore there's no such thing as nothing. That's Parmenides. Ancient Greek thought. But that comes up a lot too, especially in continental thought. So where we are here, Kant wants to know, we got these synthetic a priori judgments, and let's we're not saying necessarily that this is correct. We're just saying this is what Kant is saying. So if you have some kind of a dispute, you want to look it up earlier or later. Because when we get to analytic thought later on, one of the things in the analytic book that Quine is going to say, he comes up with, there's a paper in there called Two Dogmas of Empiricism. And what he says, what Quine is going to say in analytic thought in about the 1950s, is he's going to say, remember when Kant and Hume said analytic synthetic? He said, no. Everything's synthetic. There's no such thing as analytic judgments. So, which is kind of what I think you guys are starting to get at, all right, generally from you two that have asked questions so far. So what Quine's going to say in the 20th century, 1950s, he's going to go, that triangle three sides thing, you got to learn about a triangle. It's synthetic. It's not analytic. There's no such thing as analytic judgments. Everything's synthetic. And so when he says that, that means, well, we have no, if there's no analytic judgments, everything's learned. That sort of goes into the postmodern scheme. Well, then we don't really have knowledge or anything, do we? Absolutely. Knowledge goes out the window. Believe whatever you want and hang on for the ride. Okay? It's sort of what happens once Quine introduces that idea. But at least for a while, what Kant's trying to do is say, you know, I don't like the skepticism that Hume has. All right? And I don't like the craziness that this guy has. All right? The things are made out of little soul bits. That's crazy. So let's figure out how does all this work, how does knowledge work? It can't be reducible to monads. And it can't be that things like causality and induction, that we don't have the grounds to actually think about these things. So what we need to do, okay, is figure out and how synthetic a priori judgments are possible. All right. So, for example, we're about to get into section 6, but I will, just looking over section 5, I want to go over it briefly. He says, look, here's where we use a priori judgments, okay? And he says these are apodictic, all right? Which all that means is that they're, you know them with absolute certainty. So anytime you see a word in these philosophers that just seems completely new to you, just underline it, look it up, all right? Because it just means rudimentary, all right? That's the first paragraph under section 5. But he says this. Let's look at where we use a priori stuff, all right? A priori synthetic judgments. He says we do this in math all the time. That's what he's saying under section 5, paragraph 1. All mathematical judgments, without exception, are synthetic. All right, which is what we were just going over with all those numbers. Okay, then he, underneath that number 2, he says natural science contains a priori synthetic judgments. So we use these things in science as well. Then he comes to metaphysics and says, metaphysics is where there's a problem. Okay, metaphysics, even if we look upon it as having hitherto failed in all its endeavors, in other words, anytime someone starts talking about these things, they start to screw up, is yet, owing to the nature of human reason, is quite indispensable science and ought to contain a priori synthetic knowledge. So he's saying, if metaphysics is a real branch of human knowledge, then it needs to have synthetic a priori judgments in it, because all the other important things that we know have synthetic a priori propositions as well. So, like, science and math, that really, knowledge comes out of science and math, right? Science of all things, math of all types. All of these have synthetic a priori propositions in them, things that we know. Again, not contained, the predicate, where the predicate's not contained in the subject, but we know it prior to experience. So metaphysics should have that too. And spoiler alert, he's going to eventually say, it doesn't have these. And therefore, metaphysics is impossible. And he writes a lovely book entitled Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics, where he says the exact same thing that he says in the Critique of Pure Reason, but then says, yeah, we can't do that. We can't do metaphysics. So how he's eventually going to conclude is by saying all these things? No. Sure, they're out there, maybe. Maybe there is a God. Maybe we're free. Maybe the soul is immortal. But you can't know it. And so he says, he's going to say later on, I've done all this that he's going to do. We need to explain the mechanics of it furthermore in a moment. But he said, I did all this. So these things can be the realm of faith. You can believe in God, and that's okay. But don't expect to have scientific knowledge about God. All right? You can believe that you have free will, but don't expect to have scientific, apodictic knowledge of free will. You can believe that you have a soul that's immortal, and that's great, but you can't really know anything about your soul, all right? Because, you know, it's like Hume said, it's not something that you can synthetically evaluate. How many pounds does your soul weigh? Oh, no, in soul pounds. You can't find that out. You can't measure it, all right? Because it doesn't have extension. Hume's going to say in The Empiricist that, you know, unextended things cannot be measured, and so they can't really be confirmed. So even something like the soul or even thought itself is not something that can be confirmed empirically. So then he moves on to section 6, and we're coming close to the end time here, but I want to get to his main thesis. So again, all of this has been somewhat rudimentary and introductory, going, okay, you know, metaphysics is bad, science and math are great, and they all have synthetic a priori judgments. Well, now, section 6, the general problem of pure reason. Pure reason, again, that pure a priori, untainted by empirical experience or sensation. What is it? Paragraph 1, he tells us. Last sentence. How are a priori synthetic judgments possible? And this is Kant's primary project. How are they possible? So he's already admitted, we know that we have them. All right? You can dispute that all you want. Great. But I'm right, says Kant. We have these. I've proven it to you. We have it in math. We have it in science. We don't have it in metaphysics. But we have these. But how can we have these? How can it be the case we can know something before experience, but the predicate's not contained in the subject? So what he wants to know now is how. He admits that we have these, but he wants to know, how do I have these? And then he continues on in the next paragraph by, again, bashing metaphysics. That metaphysics has hitherto remained in so vacillating a state of uncertainty and contradiction is entirely due to the fact that this problem, and perhaps even the distinction between analytic and synthetic judgments, has never previously been considered. So he's saying, most people have really messed this up, and it's probably because the metaphysicians have never considered the question, how do we know things like this? He mentions, he even name drops Hume there. Among philosophers, David Hume came nearest to envisaging this problem, but still was very far from conceiving it with sufficient definiteness and universality. So he says here, his distinction that he made wasn't good enough. Right? He didn't get the distinction, because for Hume, there's no such thing as a synthetic a priori judgment, because all synthetic judgments are a posteriori. So now, moving on, how can we use pure reason? How is pure science possible? Well, what the critique of pure reason is, and this is the last paragraph of section 6, all right, this is now what he's saying, is this is the critical philosophy. So the reason why this is critique of pure reason is not, it's not critique in the sense of criticism, it's critique in the sense of being critical. Because again, this book is Der Kritik den reinen Vernunft, all right, the critique of pure reason. Kant likes that word. He writes another book called The Critique of Practical Reason, and he writes another book called The Critique of Judgment. And all these are part of what is called Kant's philosophy, sometimes called the critical philosophy. And his successors, Fichte, Hegel, Schelling, all say, oh, well, we're all critical philosophers too. We're doing what Kant's doing. And they're not. They think they are. All right? What they say, what Kant says, is that here's what my philosophy is. Right? This is on page 12. He says, how is metaphysics as a science possible? He says, the critique of reason, in the end, necessarily leads to scientific knowledge, while its dogmatic employment, on the other hand, lands us in dogmatic assertions to which other assertions equally specious can always be opposed. That is, in skepticism. So I want to avoid skepticism. I want to do a critical philosophy where I figure out how are synthetic a priori judgments possible. So that's the springboard of where he wants to get. And so we need something that's called a critique of pure reason to help us know how we know things. And that brings us to section 7. So he says this, the idea and division of a special science under the title Critique of Pure Reason. So we need something new. We need a science of pure reason. We have natural science, we have mathematics, those are great. We need a science that tells us how we know what we know. How we know synthetic a priori judgments. Because math and science, the areas where we say that's our knowledge, really. All the knowledge, the main knowledge we have is mathematical knowledge or scientific knowledge. That's knowledge. But a precondition of that knowledge is the existence of synthetic a priori judgments that we have. So now we need to take a step back from those sciences and come up with a science that says, how do we know those things? All right? That's what pure reason is. How do we know these things, especially before we know them? All right. So there should be a special science. And he starts off, it's like a research thesis in this first paragraph. He says, maybe this won't be possible, but let's give it a shot. All right. It'll be great. All right. It may or may not be possible, but what it can do is it can correct the errors that we have now in philosophy and in science and in mathematics. And the buzzword, I'm going to end with this term. Okay. This philosophy is going to be what he calls transcendental. So sometimes, in addition to being called critical, it's called transcendental. And that is a super, 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 super important word for Kant. Transcendental. Now, I'll explain this term and then we'll call it a day. Transcendental does not mean, like when you think of like someone like Thoreau, all right? Just experience, all right? All right? I think of Walden, all right? Hopefully no one in English is hearing me. That's not really transcendental. I expect Dr. Back to walk by angrily, all right? What he means by transcendental is this. It also doesn't mean, like, you know, we think of transcendental as in, like, dude, have you listened to this new transcendental rock, man? It's awesome. All right, like, trippy or something like that. It doesn't mean that. By transcendental, it means conditional. Conditional not in the sense of an implication, but conditional in this way. What, by transcendental he means this, what are the conditions for the knowledge that we have? In other words, what mechanism, what apparatus, what do we already have in place before we can have knowledge of anything? So you might say, well, right now you might go, well, we need a brain, we need us to be here. Okay, great, great, great. So transcendental, what do we need to have? What are the conditions that have to already be in existence before we can have the knowledge that we possess? What has to be there first? Right? There has to be something there. Like for Descartes, it was, what do I have to know first? Cogito, I have to know I'm here. So Kant's going to give a much more complicated answer to that question. And so I'll stop there. We'll talk more, but we'll pick up next time with transcendental. And so if you haven't started reading Kant, start reading there where it says transcendental doctrine of elements. So that's the part that comes first. All right? Transcendental aesthetic, transcendental analytic, and my personal favorite Kant phrase, the transcendental unity of the apperception. Okay? So we'll talk about that next time, and then we might get into Fichte as well. So if you haven't already, go ahead and take a look at the Fichte. That's what we'll be doing next.